Hello, everyone. Welcome to Oncology Decoded. I'm your host, Manoj Bhupathi. With me is Ben Garmazee. Ben, how are you this morning?
Doing good. Excited to be back. I feel like while we're releasing these, we may not have recorded one of these in the last few weeks after summer travel and everything. So kind of excited to get back into the swing of things.
I agree. This has been a while since we've done one. Today, we're actually going to talk about something different than our usual conversations. We're going to talk about testicular cancer. We're really grateful for all of you to join us, and really encourage you to reach out to us at Oncology Decoded. You can email us at podcast@oncologydecoded or follow us on X at Oncology Decoded. Ben, why don't you introduce our guest today?
Yeah, so today I'm really excited. We have Nabil Adra. He's a very talented GU medical oncologist at Indiana University. He's an associate professor there. And obviously today we wanted to bring him on because Indiana is known as being one of the premier spots to get care if you have testicular cancer or germ cell tumors. So we figured why not go straight to the spot where the experts are and get some information from them to teach us community oncologists how to treat this disease that's so highly curable. But also, when it's so highly curable, we want to make sure that we get it right. So, Nabil, why don't you say a few words about yourself and your practice?
Great. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Manoj. Appreciate you having me on. So I'm Nabil Adra. I'm an associate professor of medicine and urology at Indiana University. I specialize in GU cancers and focus mostly on testicular and prostate cancer. Excited to be with you guys today and talk a bit more about testicular cancer, which is obviously a passion of mine. So.
Awesome. Well, welcome. Again, we're very privileged to have you on. So really appreciate it. To kind of level set, Nabil, can you tell us what your how do you approach testicular cancer when you're first seeing these young patients or so in your practice?
So a lot of those patients show up, with a painless testis mass, and honestly, they end up with urology first before medical oncology. But the most common presentation would be a painless testicular mass, and an ultrasound would typically make a diagnosis showing a hypoechoic mass. That's his most typical presentation, and then the next phase is to really, once you have that, that's really pathognomonic of testicular cancer, and by far the most common form of testicular cancer is germ cell tumors. The next step really is to identify the stage of testis cancer. So we really want to try and stage what the extent is. So we've got imaging techniques, really CT scans, chest, abdomen, pelvis is important to obtain a baseline for the majority of these tumors. But also importantly, we've got really good tumor markers in testis cancer. So AFP and ATG are tumor markers that are quite specific for testis cancer, although they can be sometimes elevated in other conditions as well. And that's important to recognize. And LDH is a relatively non-specific tumor marker, but we do tend to use it in testis cancer as well, mostly as part of risk stratification as well. But that's typically the presentation. The workup is usually with imaging and tumor markers. And based on the results of the imaging and on the blood test, you can identify what stage of disease you're dealing with, and then you can sort of put together a treatment plan.
Yeah, I think that's super helpful, and I think one of the keys is, that I personally believe in, I'm a specialist, right? Manoj, you're a specialist. We see a lot of these cancers, and often we don't go to the NCCN guidelines necessarily every time to think about what to do because we just know it, right? However, in testicular cancer, because of the prescriptive nature of the therapy, I find myself going every single time to the NCCN guidelines, reviewing the information, not just from a risk stratification standpoint, which is going to help guide treatment that we're going to get to in a little bit later, but also after therapy or during surveillance to make sure that that prescriptive monitoring program is actually in place and the way I want it in the EMR. And I also remind my, advanced practice providers, my nurse practitioner, my PA as well to do the same thing every single time to make sure we get it right. So that's the first thing. Before we dive into treatment, I did hear something about CT scans, and I recall, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Nabil, I recall something about MRI perhaps coming in and taking the place of CT scans because we think about the radiation involved in the CT scans. Now, most of our solid tumor oncology patients, that radiation risk of secondary malignancy manifests over 30 years and perhaps doesn't rise to the top of our concern level. Thinking about a man who may be 27, 26, perhaps it does. So, can you tell us? Is that risk overblown? Should we be thinking about MRI? I know most patients are getting CT scans.
Yeah, I think the majority of patients get CT scans. MRIs are, just as good as CT scans for the majority of cases. The issue is, as oncologists, we're not as trained to read MRIs. And so a lot of times we want to look at our own scans and evaluate them. And so The majority of patients will not need many CT scans in their lifetime, especially if they're like stage one or early stage two. They'll get CT scans for a few years and they'll be done. And so that risk of radiation is not going to be substantial. But even if you look at the NCCN guidelines, we've now incorporated MRIs as a potential and valid alternative to CT scans. So if somebody's comfortable with MRIs, has a good radiologist at their center that reads MRIs, and if a patient is concerned about the relative term risk of radiation, MRI, especially of the abdomen and pelvis, is just as good as CT scans in reporting for testis cancer as well. The other important thing to discuss with testis cancer too, at time of diagnosis too, is those are young patients, mostly in their 20s and 30s. So you always want to think of long-term fertility, sperm banking, and so on. So that's something that we discuss with all our patients when they present, whether they're going to get chemotherapy or not. It's important to discuss sperm banking with those patients and to refer them to a sperm banking center before committing them to any sort of treatment, specifically if you're going to commit them to chemotherapy.
Nabil, kind of adding on to the diagnostic workup, you were talking about tumor markers. How often do you see tumor markers negative with a diagnosis of seminoma or non-seminoma? And how do you monitor their tumor markers pre and post-operatively if they were negative to begin with?
Yeah, so in general, when you look at germ cell tumors, AFP and ACG will be elevated in about 60% of patients with germ cell tumors altogether, right? So about 40% of patients will have negative tumor markers, and they're not super helpful in their diagnosis or their treatment course. When you look at seminoma, ACG is the only elevated tumor marker. By definition, AFP is never going to be elevated in seminoma, so it's only ACG elevation. But typically, those ACG elevations are mild. So it's not very very highly elevated. In non-seminoma, you see both AFP and ACG that could be elevated, and so you have to follow both, obviously, throughout the diagnosis and treatment course as well. Typically, what you want to do is you want to get those tumor markers pre-orchiectomy, so before patients have their orchiectomy, and then you want to get it post-orchiectomy as well. And you need to be cognizant of the half-life of those tumor markers. So the half-life of AFP is somewhere around 5 to 7 days. So if somebody's AFP before surgery is about 100, then you want it to come down by about a half life every week, right? So if you're 100 and 1 week, you want to be 50, another week, you want to be 25. Whereas ACG's half life is around 1 to 2 days. So it's a much more quick turnaround. So you want to see that ACG drop much faster after orchiectomy. So those are important numbers to keep in mind. The other important aspect that we see very frequently is AFPs. So AFPs can be mildly elevated in normal people. So we consider any AFP less than 25 as completely normal. We've published on this in the past. We get a lot of referrals for patients who have an AFP of 14 or 15, and now it goes up to 20, and the patients are referred to us for chemotherapy or even salvage chemotherapy and so on. We just tell patients that's just essentially a normal AFP. So any AFP level less than 25 is considered normal. I know that's difficult because a lot of outside labs will consider AFPs more than 8 or 9 abnormal and show up as red, and so people would freak out about that number. So that's a good sort of piece of information to consider any AFP less than 25 as normal. But those are the markers that we check. We check them pre and post orchiectomy. And obviously, if patients are going to be getting chemotherapy, then we'll check it during every cycle of chemotherapy and after chemotherapy as well.
Oh, so
that's a
that's
great
interesting.
tidbit. I
Yeah, go
go
ahead,
ahead,
Manoj.
Ben.
That's not exactly what I do, and I'm learning right now.
Me too. I was actually
So
Yeah,
what I'll
go
say
ahead.
is, look, I've the AFP thing I've adopted into my practice, right? Because our AFP lab normal range is somewhere 8 or 9, just like you mentioned, and we have patients often in their teens, and I spend a lot of time counseling those patients that we're just going to watch this, right? This is going to be viewed as normal. I also, make sure that I've heard that certain other substances can raise your AFP. I don't know how real that is, but things like marijuana and stuff I've heard in the past might elevate that. So we counsel our patients to make sure they stop that as well. The other thing, though, is the checking of the tumor marker cadence. I have been routinely checking them. Well, I don't really have the option pre-orchiectomy because generally I'm seeing these patients post-orc, but they often have been checked by the urology groups. They pre-orc, post-orc, if they're still elevated, we check another lab, just like you mentioned, for the half-life, make sure they're still downtrending because we don't know what that nadir is. But then the other thing is, once I put them on the chemo plan, I don't check them again until the end of the chemo plan. Manoj, is that how you do it, or are you checking it every cycle?
I'm checking them every cycle. And that actually was going to be my next question to Dr. Adra, asking him, when you're looking at your downtrend of your AFP or beta HCG, what is there a pattern or an amount of downturn that you want in these lab values when someone's on chemotherapy. And then we're emphasizing the AFP, or you're emphasizing the AFP and the beta HCG. We're not really talking about the LDH. Sometimes you can see that the LDH is actually rising while these two other markers are declining. So how do you interpret that from a treatment standpoint?
So a lot to unpack here. So first off, for the false positive elevations, you're right, Ben. There's some issues that can cause false elevations in AFP and ACG. AFP is mostly can be familial elevation in AFP. Liver disease can cause false elevation in AFP as well, and there's other less common conditions. So that's one aspect to it. ACGs, marijuana can cause mild elevation in ACG levels, usually in the 20s, 30s, 40s, usually not in the hundreds or 200 range. But if we get a patient post-orchiectomy who has normal scans and ACG is 30, my first thing that I do is I don't start chemotherapy. I ask them, do you smoke marijuana? And if they do, ask them, well, stop marijuana and check another ACG in a week. And a lot of times it'll just go down to normal. The other aspect is ACG can have cross-reactivity with LH. So a lot of those patients, because of their low testosterone level, LH levels can cross-react and cause a false elevation with ACG in the lab. So what we do with those patients is we give them a shot of depot testosterone and we check an ACG level a week later. A lot of those patients, that ACG number will be back to normal. Again, those are low levels of ACG elevations, not huge elevated levels of ACG. But
No,
those are
that's
some
super
really trivial
helpful.
stuff to do with ACG and AFP. Now, the idea of how do you what are we happy with as far as tumor marker decline? I think it's a bit different for several patients. So for a patient pre-orchiectomy with an AFP or ACG about 100 or 200, you want to see those numbers come down by half-lives. There's never an urgency to start chemotherapy on somebody who has an elevated ACG with normal scans, right? Like somebody who has an ACG of 100 pre-orchiectomy, post-orchiectomy, let's say first check a week later, it's 80. Not great, right? You want to see it come down more, but you don't really necessarily need to start chemotherapy urgently because those patients have good risk disease. Whether you start chemo when the HCG is 80 or quite honestly 200 or 500, their prognosis is going to be the same. So you really never want to commit patients to chemotherapy before you see a clear and unequivocal rise in those tumor markers. So in those patients, you want to check your HCG and AFP levels regularly, once a week or so on, until you see several values that are consistently going up. And as far as how quickly they come down during chemotherapy, AFP should come down according to its half-life with chemotherapy. The one tricky aspect is ACG. When you start off with a patient who has very high ACG levels, let's say 30,000, 50,000, or 100,000, a lot of times what happens with chemotherapy is the number will come down quickly initially. So it'll go from 100,000 down to 50, 25, 10, and then let's say 1,000. But then it will slowly come down after chemotherapy. And so let's say somebody who starts off with an ACG of 50,000 finishes their 4 cycles of chemotherapy, and now their ACG is 500. It doesn't necessarily mean they're progressing. All you have to do with those patients is follow those ACG levels weekly or every other week. And as long as they're coming down, they're fine. We've reported on many patients who continue to normalize their ACG many months after chemotherapy. A lot of those patients take 3 or 4 months for that ACG number to come down to normal. So there's a plateau in the decline of ACG. Don't have to freak out or panic about it. Just watch it weekly or every couple of weeks. If it comes down to normal, you're good. This patient is likely cured. If it starts rising and unequivocally rising, that's a patient who's progressing and needed to initiate salvage chemotherapy. Now, the LDH question, that's a tough question. So there's differences of opinion there. In our opinion, LDH is merely just a bulk of the disease and not necessarily a tumor marker per se, like AFP and ACG. Seminoma patients who have very large retroperitoneal lymph nodes, they tend to have elevated LDH. The safe thing to do is, first of all, never initiate chemotherapy based on an LDH that's elevated only. So never consider LDH as a sole independent tumor marker. Now, if you have an AFP that's rising and an LDH that's rising, that's fine. You feel more comfortable about it. But never start chemo based on an LDH level that's elevated. Certainly never initiate second-line chemo based on an LDH level that's elevated. The other controversial area is risk stratification. If somebody has an LDH level that puts them in the intermediate or poor risk category, but their AFP and ACG are in the good risk and their scans and everything puts them in the good risk, we consider those patients as good risk patients. We don't put them in it. We never consider LDH as a sole independent prognostic marker. It helps you in the treatment course. It helps you in sort of determining the treatment plan, but it should never be a sole marker to determine initiating treatment or risk stratification.
I think that's incredible information, and I think we need to highlight that, right, to all of our listeners. That is a key nugget here that a lot of us may not be as familiar with. So I think that's super helpful. I think the information on tumor marker growth and trajectory is great. I do want to get onto treatment selection, but I have one final quick question, I think, before we do that. And it says, because I'm not checking my tumor markers every cycle because it makes me, nervous to explain to patients what that means. And it's so regimented out. I'm going to do 3 cycles of BEP or 4 cycles of EP or 4 cycles of BEP or BEIP, whatever it may be. I'm going to continue that until it's done. Is that an incorrect way of be viewing this? Should I be, if the tumor markers aren't going down as much as I want them to after 1 or 2 cycles, should I be thinking about pivoting therapy?
So almost never do we pivot therapy based on a tumor marker decline only. So almost always you're going to continue your course of therapy. Although having that trend in AFP and ACG can be helpful in determining what's this patient's prognosis looking like. So somebody who has tumor marker is declining but not as appropriately, that might be a patient you're going to watch much closer, where you're going to start them on second line chemotherapy likely after you finish frontline therapy. And we do have patients where we see their tumor markers rise during third or fourth cycle of therapy. And for those patients, we stop their third or fourth course of therapy and we switch them to second line therapy. So I do think it's important to check tumor markers during every cycle of treatment.
You've just changed my practice. This
Yes.
is great. That's why we do this, right, Manoj? That's why we do this. So, if it's okay with you, Manoj, time to move on to treatment, demystifying our chemotherapy regimens, or do you have something else?
No, it's totally okay with me. No problem at all. Why don't we start with the BEP versus EP question, if that's okay with you?
All
I'm
right.
curious to understand that. How much importance does the B actually play when you're say 3 cycles of BEP versus 4 cycles of EP are considered equivalent? And how does one pick one versus the over other outside of like pulmonary toxicities and functional age or performance status and such? Is there really a difference when you're picking that?
All right, so the big question in germ cell tumor, right? So first of all, this is when you look at patients with metastatic disease, you're going to risk stratify them based on the IGCC-CG risk stratification. This is in all the guidelines essentially, but you're essentially going to divide them into patients with good, intermediate, or poor risk disease. And this is based on the amplitude of elevation of your tumor markers, the AFP and ACG. It's based on whether your patients have non-pulmonary visceral metastases, so that's liver, bone, brain metastases, and whether patients have a primary mediastinal non-seminoma. So for seminoma patients, seminoma can only be good or intermediate risk. You do not have poor risk seminoma. For seminoma, the only way you can have intermediate risk disease is if you have non-pulmonary visceral metastasis, which is liver, lung, liver, bone, or brain metastasis. For non-seminoma, you have good, intermediate, or poor. Intermediate risk is if your AFP is between 1,000 and 10,000, if your ATG is between 5,000 and 50,000. So that's your intermediate risk category. And then your poorest disease are patients who have an ATG more than 50,000, an AFP more than 10,000, patients who have non-pulmonary visceral metastasis, so liver, bone, or brain metastasis, or patients who have a primary mediastinal non-seminoma. And so once you have your risk stratification done, so that's based on your imaging and tumor markers, now you can determine what treatment course you can offer. For good risk disease, the options are either BEP times 3 or EP times 4. For intermediate and poor risk disease, you really need 3 cycles of triple drug therapy for the majority of patients. There are some nuances for intermediate risk disease, which we can talk about, but for the majority, you're looking at 4 cycles of either BEP or VIP, which is etoposide diphosphamide cisplatin. Now let's go to good risk disease, which was where your question is. For good risk disease, the 2 options are BEP times 3 or EP times 4. There really is no data that shows that one regimen is better than the other. There's different institutions that have preference for one regimen over another, and there's different thought processes behind that. So the only study that really compared BEP times 3 versus EP times 4 head to head was a French study. In that study, there was no statistically significant difference in outcomes. However, numerically, patients with BEP times 3 had improved outcomes, improved survival with BEP times 3 compared to EP times 4. That was just a numerical improvement. And as you know, when you have cure rates as high as 90, 95% in good risk disease, it's very hard to show statistically significant improvement. Now let's talk about toxicity. So bleomycin, it's important to select patients for bleomycin. So we never offer bleomycin for patients who are age more than 50. We never offer bleomycin for patients who have a serum creatinine more than 2. And we never offer bleomycin for patients who have intrinsic lung disease. That's a patient with cystic fibrosis, really bad COPD, or anything like that. So really, patients who are otherwise healthy, which is the majority of patients in their 20s and 30s diagnosed with testis cancer, who don't have intrinsic lung disease, who have normal renal function, right? And those are patients who can be candidates for BEP. Now, when you select patients appropriately, you almost never run into issues with 3 cycles of BEP, which is 9 doses of bleomycin. We've treated, probably hundreds and thousands of patients here at our center with BEP times three. We've never had any issues with bleomycin toxicity when you select those patients appropriately. Importantly, you have to examine those patients, do physical examination with every cycle, check for lung crackles and rales on their lung exam, check for their appropriate expansion to make sure there's no issues with their lung expansion. If you notice problems with their expansion, then you probably have to drop bleomycin for the last cycle or so. But when you look at BEP times three, really you're looking at 9 doses of bleomycin and you're looking at 3 cycles of cisplatin-based therapy. Why do we prefer BEP times three over EP times four? In our opinion, and there's data to support this now from survivorship studies, that fourth cycle of platinum is what causes the long-term toxicity. That's what caused most of the long-term neurotoxicity, ototoxicity. We now probably know some problems with renal dysfunction and other issues. So you want to really try and avoid that long-term toxicity. We know those patients, the majority are going to be cured. Cure rate for Goodrich's disease is 90 to 95%. So when I talk with my patients, I tell them, the question is likely not whether you're going to be cured. You're almost certainly going to be cured. The question is how you're going to be cured. I would like to cure you with the least amount of long-term toxicity so that you can live 20, 40, 60 more years or 80 more years, you having good quality of life. And that's why I feel like that fourth cycle of platinum is what causes the most toxicity. And that's why I feel like BEP times three is the more appropriate regimen to avoid additional additive toxicity from cisplatin. And so BEP times three is the preferred regimen here at IU. At other centers, EP times four is preferred because of concerns with BEP. But like I said, as long as you select patients appropriately and select patients for bleomycin appropriately, you usually do not run into trouble.
So that brings two follow-up questions for me. So one, I also kind of lean a little bit more on BEP than EP for the things you've mentioned, right? I also get worried about the etoposide dosing, thinking about secondary malignancy. Maybe that's still really small, and maybe we haven't shown that that matters between 4 and 3 cycles, but that also makes me nervous. The second thing, though, is I'm thinking about how do I monitor a patient on bleomycin because of that concern? Obviously, the skin toxicity is a concern. We can counsel patients on what to look for. I haven't seen that really too often. The lung toxicity, though, I'm going to push back a little bit on. And what I would say is, while I haven't seen horrible pulmonary fibrosis or some of these very feared complications of bleomycin, I have seen routine drops in DLCO as I repeat PFTs traditionally midway through, about after 2 cycles, to see if I should give 3 more doses of bleomycin. Is that overcautious or is that something that's appropriate? And if it is appropriate to then think about maybe I shouldn't give more bleomycin into a man who's not subjectively having dyspnea, but now having some changes on the PFTs, do I need to add a 4th cycle of EP or am I good just to drop the bleomycin and stick to just the 3 cycles as planned? What would you do there?
So I think you're always going to see some drop in DLCO at some point. The vast majority, and maybe correct me from your practice, Ben, is the vast majority of these are completely clinically insignificant. Like those
Okay.
patients are completely normal. They're not having any respiratory symptoms. It's just a number on the PFTs. So our practice is really for good risk patients who are getting BEP times three. We don't even get PFTs. We just do regular physical examination on those patients with every cycle. And as long as they don't have any symptoms, no cough, no physical exam findings, we push with the 9 doses of bleomycin. Where we do check PFTs is for those patients who are going to get 4 cycles of BEP. So that's for intermediate and poor risk patients. For those patients, we get baseline PFTs, and then we get PFTs before the fourth and last cycle of BEP. And for those patients, if we see a substantial drop in DLCO, that's where we drop the bleomycin. And instead of giving BEP for that last fourth and final cycle, we give VIP instead of BEP.
And what about if you have to drop bleomycin? Would you give a 4th cycle of EP in that setting?
Usually, yes, we would give a 4th cycle of EP. And also have to look at the volume of disease. I mean, some patients are really on a very, very good risk of the spectrum. So for those patients, you might decide not to give a 4th cycle. And for others, you might feel like they have a more bulk of disease. You want to give a 4th cycle. So it just depends on a patient for that particular situation.
This is super helpful. I've definitely learned a lot. I've not utilized PFTs as much. I mean, that was part of my training. We don't usually check PFTs, and actually not done it even in the four cycles of PEP. So, going forward, I'm going to end up doing that now, at least getting a baseline. And then after third cycle or third round of PEP before we go on to the fourth and then switching to therapy.
Yeah, great. Because who knows, you're not doing it enough and I'm doing it too much, it sounds like. Got to go meet in the middle here. Go in the middle, yeah.
I am curious, kind of shifting gears a little bit in the treatment side. When instead of doing instead of doing chemotherapy up front, for some of your patients that are stage two, how often do you proceed with surgery up front versus chemotherapy, and how do you make that determination for it? And in a true community, it's not always easy finding surgeons that are wanting to do an RPLND and such. So any tips that you can give us on that?
Yeah, so again, this is all around the same theme as you want to cure patients, but when you want to cure them with the least amount of toxicity. That's why it's important doing testis cancer right, because those are patients who are going to live many, many more years of life. You're going to cure them, which is amazing, but you want to subject them to the least amount of toxicity while curing them. So for stage two patients, you really want to look at the extent of their stage two disease. So you got stage two A, B, and C, and you really want to look at your size of that retroperitoneal lymph node. So for seminoma and non-seminoma, it's a bit different. If you're dealing with seminoma and if you have lymph nodes that are less than 3 centimeters, the typical historic recommendation would have been to do radiation for those patients, right? To do radiation for those retroperitoneal lymph nodes. We have tried to move away from that in recent history because of the potential long-term toxicity of radiation, secondary malignancies, and so on. So there's been several single-arm phase two trials, including the SAMS trial here in the US, which was the largest trial in the US, looking at RPLND as an option for those early stage non-bulky stage two seminoma. And it did show about an 80% cure rate when you do a proper RPLND with a skilled urologist in this patient population. So this is part of the NCCN guidelines now, and I'll tell you, at Indiana University, this has been our strong preference. We do RPLND for all patients with stage two seminoma who have retroperitoneal lymph nodes less than 3 centimeters. And the caveat is that the patient should be fit for that, and that the patient can have access to somebody to do an appropriate RPLND, somebody who has quite a bit of experience in doing that RPLND. So that's for seminoma. For non-seminoma, really for it's the same sort of approach. For patients who have non-bulky stage two non-seminoma lymph nodes less than 3 centimeters, we do prefer RPLND for that patient population as well. Again, we want to avoid chemotherapy if at all possible. A question comes up a lot is if you do an RPLND first and you find a lot of disease in that RPLND, do you give adjuvant chemotherapy afterwards? I'll tell you that even in the guidelines, it can be confusing. I'll tell you our answer here at IU would be no. The reason we did the RPLND to start with is to avoid chemotherapy. So to me, it makes no sense to do an RPLND and then give chemotherapy. You would have given chemotherapy up front. So really, if you're going to commit a patient to an RPLND for stage two disease, our strong preference is to do surveillance afterwards because you really are curing about 80% of those patients. And you bring up a very good question, is not everybody has access to a good surgeon and so on. But the testis cancer community is very open to helping people all around the country. Honestly, you can reach out to any one of us, whether it's on the medical oncology side or the urology side. We're happy to see those patients very efficiently, get them in and get them taken care of. It's important, chemotherapy, whether it's done in Indiana or anywhere else, is pretty much the same. As long as you do the same regimen and on time, remain on time and on schedule, you're not going to run into trouble. But the way where you run into trouble is when you do an RPLND with a surgeon who doesn't have experience doing those surgeries. And so that can be problematic. So we really want to have those surgeries done at a center for excellence and somebody who is really skilled and experienced in doing those surgeries.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. In our community market, we give the chemotherapy, but oftentimes the vast, vast, vast majority of cases are getting referred out for surgery. Now, some of those will go to Vanderbilt here in Nashville, but a lot of them will actually go to your center, right, with your talented surgeons at Indiana. I've sent a lot to Dr. Carey and some of the other surgeons up there. So that's been something very important and stressed with our urologists as well, who are actually guiding those referrals as well, because they know that this is a disease that cures patients and it has to be done so carefully. It's an extensive surgery and it's a complex surgery, and we really need to refer these patients. Manoj, I think I cut you off. So what were you going to say?
All good. So I was going to ask two questions, right? So one, Dr. Rafter, you had mentioned cure a couple of times, right? Generally speaking, a solid tumor GU specialist, when you have patients that have liver mets, brain mets, bone mets, you don't think about cure as an option.
Yeah.
One of the questions that always comes up is, well, what is the likelihood of my cancer is actually really going to be cured if I have brain metastasis?
Yeah.
And are you utilizing radiation or anything in that situation? That's the first question. The second question is very similarly, with all the cytotoxics that we're using, you oftentimes see significant pancytopenias, right? We do dose modifications, we do dose holds for those patients in other tumor types. But in testicular cancer, it's quite the opposite. You tend not to do that. And so, can you comment on both those things?
Yeah. So chance of cure, again, you go back to the IGCCCG stratification one. So you look at that stratification, and we've updated that data. There's newer data from the 2000s as well, from whether it's institutional from IU or whether it's from the whole IGCCCG. You can see that patients with good risk disease roughly have around about 90% cure rate with combination cisplatin-based chemotherapy. Intermediate risk disease patients have roughly around the 80% cure rate. And then patients with poorest disease have somewhere around 60 to 70% cure rate. Now, patients with brain metastasis tend to do more poorly. They have a worse outcome just because that can cause more morbidity and so on. But those patients are highly curable as well. One of the problems with testis cancer is we really don't do screening brain MRIs at diagnosis to look for those brain metastases. So one thing that we've looked at doing is put together a predictive model of what is the chance of this patient having brain metastasis at diagnosis. That way you can diagnose it early, avoid morbidity long term from it as well. And there are some predictive markers that can tell you that this patient is likely going to have brain metastasis. Patients who has a choriocarcinoma predominant histology in their orchiectomy, patients who have very high ATG levels, ATG 50,000, 100,000, and so on. Patients have very high burden of visceral metastasis, liver metastasis, bone metastasis. Those are patients who are more likely to have brain metastasis. And for me personally, for those patients, I do get screening brain MRIs at diagnosis. Obviously, if a patient has neurologic symptoms, then you get a brain MRI as well at diagnosis. But important to know that even patients with brain metastasis are very curable. Those patients require multimodal care. They sometimes require resections, SBRT. We try to avoid whole brain radiotherapy because, again, those are young patients. They have a high cure rate. We don't want them to live their whole life with the effects of whole brain radiotherapy if you can avoid it as well. But a lot of this requires multidisciplinary care, and those patients can be quite challenging to deal with. But those are curable, whether they present with brain metastasis or whether they relapse with brain metastasis, those patients can be curable.
That's great. And I think we're coming to the end here. Real quick, patients progressing on BEP or EP, we talked, you're checking tumor markers. Now I'm checking tumor markers, right? And we're thinking about next line of therapy.
Yeah.
Obviously, these patients are often going to get referred out to, tertiary quaternary centers. But if you don't have that access, right, and you got to care for the patient in front of you, should we be thinking about doing a salvage line of chemotherapy, or should we th be thinking about high dose chemo and auto transplant in that second line? And is there any distinction between how we order those treatment paradigms?
Yeah. So the question is how they're relapsing then, right? So patient, how do you determine progression? Well, that can be serologic. It can be an AFP or ACG that's clearly rising, or it can be a radiographic. It could be an enlargement of retroperitoneal lymph nodes or lung mets and so on. So, but essentially, there's three treatment options for relapse disease. You can either have salvage surgery or salvage chemotherapy with standard dose chemotherapy or high dose chemotherapy. So those are the three options. If patients relapse or progress with anatomically confined disease, so that's a patient who presented with a large retroperitoneal lymph node, got chemo, and now they're progressing with enlargement of the retroperitoneal lymph node, then really salvage surgery is perfect for that patient because that patient demonstrated that disease has really limited the retroperitoneum. And with salvage surgery, you have about a 40% cure rate with surgery alone. And so for those patients, we recommend surgery. For the other patients who are progressing with multifocal disease, the options are standard dose or high dose chemotherapy and stem cell transplant. And there's no clear data that shows that one is better than the other, although I'll tell you our institutional preference at Indiana University strongly favors high dose chemotherapy and stem cell transplant. We've published numerous series with large numbers of patients showing a cure rate of about 60% when you treat with high dose chemotherapy and transplant with those relapse patients. There's no prospective data that shows that high dose chemotherapy is better than standard dose, although there's large retrospective data from Europe with Dr. Lorch that Dr. Lorch published with over 1,500 patients showing that patients who received high dose chemotherapy had improved progression-free and overall survival compared to standard dose chemotherapy. There is a randomized controlled trial called the TIGER trial that Darren Feldman at a Memorial was running that randomizes patients with relapsed disease to either standard dose TIP or high dose chemotherapy with a TICE regimen as the initial salvage regimen. That trial has completed accrual. We're waiting for the results of that study. It has some caveats and some issues that we can discuss later, but we'll see. Pending the results of that study, our institutional preference is high dose chemotherapy. And my advice to any medical oncologist or urologist who is dealing with patients with relapsed disease, those are complicated patients. We are happy to help. Our contacts are available pretty much everywhere, whether it's by email or by phone. You're welcome to contact us anytime. We're happy to consult by phone, whether the patient wants to stay locally and get treatment locally. But even if the patient wants to come to a center of excellence in testis cancer, we're happy to get them plugged in into our system as quickly as possible. So my best advice is, identify relapse quickly. And then as soon as you identify relapse, act quickly, get in contact with us. We're always happy to help.
Great. Well, Ben and Nabil, I've definitely learned a lot in this short segment in terms of managing some of these complicated patients, as well as pearls and how you monitor for surveillance. I don't really have any other questions, Ben. Anything else that you can think of?
Yeah, I this has been one of my favorite podcasts, and I think it's incredible. Thank you for your time. I'm going to ask you to answer in one sentence, true or false, because this does come up in questions I get on the phone as well as kind of a referral center within the community for GU Care. A patient with a lot of pulmonary disease, all over, tons of pulmonary meds. You're starting with VIP or you're starting with BEP, even if they meet all your other criteria that you gave us for someone who's safe to get bleomycin. Which
So
one?
lots of pulmonary meds, to be honest, even if they, I would probably prefer VIP over BEP for this patient population. And there is a subset of that patient population that tend to have hemoptysis and bleeding with their initial cycle of therapy. So a lot of times what we do is cycle zero for those patients where we give just 3 days of EP. A lot of times those patients will have more hemoptysis. They might need to go on the ventilator for a few days. And then 3 weeks, they almost always recover. They feel better. And then in 3 weeks, we start the full four cycles of VIP. So very large burden of lung metastasis, we typically would prefer VIP.
So that's great. I just want to put that nugget out there as well, because I think that's relevant to community oncologists. It's something that I've been doing as well. And I just also, before I put it out there, wanted to make sure I was right. So thank you, Nabil. While I mixed up AFP and HCG with marijuana earlier, I was able to correct the record
Yes.
on pulmonary burden of disease and bleomycin. So yes, Manoj, I think we're good. I think this was outstanding. I can't wait to get this out there and get it to all of our listeners to really help hopefully elevate community care of, germ cell tumors.
I completely agree. Thank you again so much, Dr. Otter, for joining us this morning and reviewing testicular cancer. Really, really appreciate your time and expertise in this matter. With that, thank you all for listening and the support that you provide us at Oncology Decoded. We look forward to having you join us on another session. Follow us at Oncology Decoded on X, as well as email us at podcast@oncologydecoded.com. Thank you all.